Hello. Tonight I'm going to look at Blake's America, a prophecy. It is one of the shorter visionary poems, which dates between 1791 and 1793, and deals with Blake's interpretation of the American Revolution, a cause of great opposition to the British government. His story of America follows the rebellion of the 13 American colonies and Britain's hopeless response. Blake sets it up as a cosmic battle over the Atlantic between his hero George Washington and the inept George III, guardian prince of Albion. In America, Blake begins to create his own pantheon of players. He wrote, "I must create a system or be enslaved by another man's." So he invents a cast of characters that reappear and interact with one another, their nature and relationships revealing Blake's beliefs, hopes and fears. Blake's cast is a sort of self-enclosed private system. Blake is assuming we will be interested enough to try and work out who the players are, what, as you'll hear, Orc and Orthona stand for. His idea behind any one of the characters seems to originate in a range of arcane sources, and it's difficult to be quite sure of who is what and what he's driving at a lot of the time. It begins. The shadowy daughter of Orthona stood before Red Orc, when 14 sons had faintly journeyed o'er his dark abode. His food she brought in iron baskets, his drink in cups of iron. Crowned with a helmet and dark hair, the nameless female stood, a quiver with its burning stores, a bow like that of night. When pestilence is shot from heaven, no other arms she need. Invulnerable though naked, save where clouds roll round her loins, their awful folds in the dark air, silent she stood as night, for never from her iron tongue could voice or sound arise, but dumb till that dread day when Orc essayed his fierce embrace. So here in the opening lines is the first time we see Orc in Blake's writing. He is the child of Loss and Enid Arman, Blake's symbols of inspiration and imagination. Here Blake is characterising him as an angry teenager, chained up, representative of the American Revolution. He represents sexual, political, religious and psychic revolt, all at once. Orthona is one of Blake's four Zoas, who, if you're reading a version of Blake with footnotes, also represents inspiration and imagination. The four Zoas combined are equal to Albion, Blake's great symbol of England before the Norman yoke, before the imposition of a class system, which Blake saw as some sort of innocent paradise. You do have to read this poem with some sort of guide, I think. Mine is W.H. Stevenson, Poems of William Blake, which has the most elaborate notes of any edition I know. The verse goes on. "Dark virgin," said the hairy youth, "thy father stern abhorred, rivets my tenfold chains while still on high my spirit soars. Sometimes an eagle screaming in the sky, sometimes a lion stalking upon the mountains, and sometimes a whale I lash, the raging fathomless abyss, anon a serpent folding. Around the pillars of Orthona, and round thy dark limbs, on the Canadian wilds I fold, feeble my spirit folds. For chained beneath I rend these caverns, when thou bringest food I hung my joy, and my red eyes seek to behold thy face. In vain these clouds roll to and fro, and hide thee from my sight." Blake attempts to create a powerful atmosphere in these lines. Orthona's shadowy daughter with the red of the raging Orc, which is charged with a kind of blind sexuality. The next plate or chapter goes, "Silent as despairing love and strong as jealousy, the hairy shoulders rend the links, free of the wrists of fire. Round the terrific loins he sees the panting, struggling womb. It joyed she put aside her clouds and smiled her firstborn smile, as when a black cloud shows its lightnings to the silent deep." The form is based on the authorised version of the Bible, so there are long lines which function like individual verses in the Old and New Testament, and it's prophetic vision, but the problem is it doesn't have enough cadence or music. There's a cloudy, relentless quality, long lines which aren't metrically interesting. They don't skip or sing. And when I read the last lines of this section, I think Blake is feeling the frustration of the form too. "The stern bard ceased. Ashamed of his own song, enraged, he swung his harp aloft, sounding, then dashed its shining frame against a ruined pillar and glittering fragments. Silent he turned away and wandered down the vales of Kent in sick and drear lamentings." But it's worth remembering here that America was richly illustrated by Blake on an unusually large scale. The plates were twice the size of any previous work, and the images of the figure are radiant and strange. Peter Ackroyd, Blake's biographer, describes these images as immeasurably more radiant and spectacular than any other artist of his period. A huge winged figure, bowed in despair upon a broken wall, an old man hastening into darkness through a stone portal, a nude youth sitting beside a skull, looking expectantly towards the sky, a bearded patriarch extending his arms before some clouds. The heroic or terrible figures of Michelangelo have fallen into an abyss. The American Revolution caused one of the bloodiest battles of all time. It began in 1775 and concluded with a preliminary peace treaty in 1782. For Blake, it was unquestionably a political conflict caused by irreconcilable differences about how the American colonies should be governed. By 1776, Parliament decreed that the British, led by the monarchy, must exercise unchallenged authority in all parts of the empire, including the power to tax Americans without their consent. Americans believed that they were entitled to certain fundamental rights, the rights of Englishmen, meaning the right of self-determination, to make laws in a separate fledgling state, which ultimately would undermine the authority of the monarchy and government, giving America democracy and independence, something Blake would have strongly supported. And in America he writes, "What God is he writes laws of peace and clothes him in a tempest? What pitying angel lusts for tears and fans himself with sighs? What crawling villain preaches abstinence and wraps himself in fat of lambs? No more I follow, no more obedience pay." In America, Blake is committed to writing a literary prophecy. For him, this is not prophetic in the literal sense, but it's more an imaginative engagement with history, in which the vision of outward things, historical events, is joined with inward vision, which is imaginative and rich with meaning and value. But later in America, he includes real characters. In the section entitled Prophecy, and here we have Blake inside the zeitgeist, the spirit of the age, he says, "The guardian prince of Albion burns in his nightly tent. Sullen fires across the Atlantic glow to America's shore, piercing the souls of warlike men who rise in silent night. Washington, Franklin, Payne and Warren, Gates, Hancock and Greene meet on the coast glowing with blood from Albion's fiery prince." England's King George III is the guardian prince, also Albion's wrathful prince. And you get these figures in the American Revolution who are permanently there in Blake's visionary lines. And actually, I think it's like a transatlantic television hookup. It's visual, like a contemporary news report, as you can imagine the gathering of these figures in a camera shot, recognisable revolutionaries whose image is being transmitted in England, here by Blake. And all the 13 angels, the states of America. In the deep gloom by Washington and Payne and Warren they stood, and the flame folded roaring fierce within the pitchy night, before the demon red who burnt towards America, and black smoke thunders and loud winds rejoicing in its terror. America is represented by the revolutionary leaders, but I notice he puts Tom Paine into the poem, center screen as it were, Washington and Payne and Warren they stood. Of course, Tom Paine with his book Common Sense, one of the intellectual founders of the revolution. But it's interesting you have historical figures and a polemical literary figure altogether all representing American freedom, which the pitchy night is trying to smother. Blake did meet Tom Paine, although he disagreed with Paine's deism, with rational Christianity, disdain for angels and miracles. He advised Paine to flee the country in 1776, which was very good advice, and Paine took it and went to Paris, where of course he was nearly guillotined, but eventually escaped over to the United States. Blake was very much like Paine in taking a Republican view of the situation. This is one of the most outstanding passages. Really, Blake is trying to communicate the zeitgeist. So he writes, "Albion is sick. America faints, enraged the zenith grew. As human blood shooting its veins all round the orbed heaven, red rose the clouds from the Atlantic in vast wheels of blood, and in the red clouds rose a wonder over the Atlantic sea. Intense, naked, a human fire, fierce glowing as the wedge of iron heated in the furnace. His terrible limbs were fire, with myriads of cloudy terrors, banners, dark and towers surrounded. Heat but not light went through the murky atmosphere." Apparently the March of 1792, when Blake was working in America, was unbearably hot, 82 degrees, and there are accounts of a kind of fervour and feverishness through London. Tom Paine, who had been outlawed from England in 1776, had made an appearance just a month before when he published his Rights of Man in February 1792, which many radical societies had endorsed. In May, there was a royal proclamation issued against diverse wicked and seditious writings, and soldiers were billeted around London to monitor any upheaval. One observer wrote at the time, "Nothing can be more evident than the growth of popular feeling in favour of the revolution, and democratic clubs are starting on all sides." Then at the beginning of 1793, the French King Louis XVI was executed, and a few weeks later war broke out between England and France, which would last for 20 years. London was a battleground, and accounts from the time reveal how lawless and violent the streets were. In Peter Ackroyd's book, he refers to this time in Blake's life as walking among fires, which I think reflects the feeling in London at the time. Blake would write, "I'm really sorry to see my countrymen trouble themselves with politics. If men were wise, the most arbitrary princes would not hurt them. If they were not wise, the freest government is compelled to be a tyranny. Princes and lords appear to me to be fools. They seem to be something else beside human life." But beside his frustration and despair, I think Blake resented the fact that he lost some feeling of spirituality at this time, when he writes, "War and politics absorb every faculty." I think this turbulent mood is reflected in his writing of America, where everything is overdone, but then there is a kind of biblical passage. "Let the slave grinding at the mill run out into the field. Let him look up into the heavens and laugh in the bright air. Let the chained soul shut up in darkness and in sighing, whose face has never seen a smile in 30 weary years, rise and look out, his chains are loose, his dungeon doors are open. And let his wife and children return from the oppressor's scourge. They look behind at every step and believe it is a dream, singing the sun has left his blackness and has found a fresher morning, and the fair moon rejoices in the clear and cloudless night, for empire is no more, and now the lion and wolf shall cease." That passage is sung by Van Morrison, who is greatly influenced by Blake, and I think more widely Blake made a strong impression on Irish writers. Yeats constructed his own mystical world in an unreadable book called The Vision, inspired by Blake. Yeats thought he'd made out Blake's prophetic books, and he even wrote, "My book on him will, I believe, clear up that riddle forever. No one will call him mad again." Yeats even believed that Blake was of Irish extraction, but then went back on that. It's a ludicrous notion, but he does characterise him as Irish in a selection of Blake's work that he did. And then Joyce celebrates Blake and Defoe in a lecture he gave in Trieste in his early 20s. He talks about Blake making breakfast in the morning, and I think the great breakfast scene where Bloom is making breakfast is in a way remembering that passage about Blake. So 214 years after it was written, what are we to make of this visionary, biblical, intermittently incoherent but rich and passionate poem, America? Would we even be reading it if it wasn't written by Blake? What does it add to what we know of him as a man and an artist? I think Blake was really brave here. Sedition was in the air, and it was a crime that carried the ultimate penalty. Ever since he failed to publish his work, The French Revolution, in 1791, Blake was prone to what he called nervous fear, a morbid suspicion that he would be the victim of prosecution or worse at the hands of the authorities. Though he removed all references to George III and to government ministers in America, A Prophecy, he was unable to find a publisher, and this marks a distinct point in Blake's career, as he would never again be able to publish on conventional-sized pages, which would have secured a larger audience. As Peter Ackroyd suggests, by 1793, when Blake was 36 years old, he must already have seen the prospects for greatness slipping away. Tomorrow I'll be looking at Blake's later mystical writings, which are among the most challenging and obscure works in English literature. Until then, good night.
Tom Paulin was discussing America, A Prophecy by William Blake in the third essay on The Artist and Poet. The programme was a Just Radio production for BBC Radio 3. This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM and on digital radio. It's 11:15. That means it's time for Late Junction with Verity Sharp. Mira, recelo,